And now, live from the Daniel Scappin Studio, deep in the foothills of the North Georgia Mountains, it's Mike Malloy.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this edition of The Malloy Show. It is Tuesday, June the 12th, 2018. And if we may, I think I saw this on Twitter. I'm not sure. If we might do this, let's take just a second here and bow our heads. And how did they used to say it? Every head bowed, every eye closed. And this is not for prayer. This is to meditate on the fact that with Donald Trump as the president, quote, quote, of the United States, we now have what he calls an excellent relationship with the dictator of the most murderous regime on earth, Kim Jong-un, and Justin Trudeau, Canada's prime minister, according to Trump spokespeople and Trump, quote, deserve to go to a special place in hell. Does that register for you? Kim Jong-un, the dictator of the most murderous regime on earth. Trump now has what he calls an excellent relationship. But Justin Trudeau deserves a special place in hell. You know, I've been talking about this for a number of podcasts. Trump is truly a fascist. There is no question whatsoever. And like attracting like, so I've heard, Trump prefers the company of fascist dictators who have the kind of power that Trump wishes he has had and is working towards developing in this country. Now, as far as the bullshit that went down in Singapore the other day, was it Singapore? See how quickly we forget? Of course, it was Singapore. But nothing new was achieved. Nothing. What Trump participated in and Kim engineered was a photo op that benefits Kim in a way that you and I, being Americans, just simply cannot comprehend. How the enslaved people in Kim's dictatorial little murder hole are going to just shriek and clap and yell and applaud and get all aroused because their leader now has been to a summit meeting with what the poor Koreans still believe, North Koreans still believe, is the leader of the free world, which Trump is not. A photo op. It had a dual purpose. It was a photo op to stroke Trump's ego. I doubt seriously if his base, so-called, these moronic fucks back here in the United States, care one way or the other about Trump and Kim Jong-un. I just don't think it matters to them. The average Trump supporter could not find the Korean Peninsula on a map, much less North Korea. So this was for Trump's ego. This is for his malignant narcissism. That was function A. Function B of this ridiculous-ass meeting was to get the jabbering idiots on television news, and yes, I'm talking about you, MSNBC, to get the gibbering, jabbering idiots on MSNBC off Mueller's investigation, Avenatti's slowly closing net, and onto this horseshit in Singapore. You know, I watched some of it, some of the MSNBC coverage. We had a little bit of it on the program last night, but I'll tell you, it didn't register with me how goddamn ridiculous it was what MSNBC was doing all day yesterday. Wall-to-wall coverage of nothing. All the camera shots, all the flags, all the this, all the that. MSNBC yesterday promoted Trump as a world leader. Now, I don't give a shit that he met with some murderous little dictator that has as much influence on world affairs as a goddamn cockroach, except where it concerns maybe he'll loose his nuclear weapons. And MSNBC brought out the big guns, right? In fact, the only person I saw who treated the whole thing like the farce it was, even MSNBC's coverage, was Brian Williams. I watched some of the coverage that started, at 8 o'clock last night, Eastern Time. And I watched Rachel Maddow going on and fucking on and fucking on like she was giving a lecture in a world politics class or to the people who were seated on that long table with Brian Williams and her and what's his name? The two people who speak Korean, the Korean Americans. Who else was there? Steve, who is it, Kathy, that comes on right before Rachel?
Ryan Hayes.
Huh?
Hayes, Chris Hayes.
Chris Hayes, that's right. Thank you. I hate these brain farts. And I think they had somebody else sitting there too. But to give this the kind of coverage that MSNBC gave it, and I'm sure CNN did the same thing. As far as Fox News, I couldn't care less about them because they broadcast to these idiots who couldn't even find North Korea or South Korea or Asia on a map. But to watch MSNBC treat this as if it had any kind of validity whatsoever just kept hitting my gag reflex every time one of the talking heads on the MSNBC channel had one more ponderous thing to say about this bullshit. I thought I was going to lose it. You know how this should have been treated? If all these television pundits are so goddamn dead serious that the worst thing that's ever happened in the United States is Trump, in terms of political leadership, if they really believed that, what the fuck were they giving him wall-to-wall coverage as if he were a statesman? What was the point? They gave total coverage to a goddamn photo op for Trump and this miserable fucking mass killer from North Korea. So madness. And the press conference that the orange orangutan gave after the summit? What fever dream did that come out of? Trump actually called Kim Jong-un, quote, very talented, end quote. In what, you fucking moron? Murdering his own family members? Sending people to a gulag? Starving millions of people to death so this fat fuck can continue to parade and prance around? And Trump calls him very talented. And to Trump he is. And you know why as well as I do. Because Trump would give his left testicle to have the kind of unfettered power that Putin or Xi or Kim or Duterte have in their countries. But especially Kim. Trump looks at that shit and just goes, holy Jesus Christ, why can't I have this? He also described the conditions in North Korea as rough. Jesus fucking Christ. Rough. I guess he would have referred to the Holocaust as difficult.
Unpleasant.
Unpleasant. Now, the terms that I kept hearing in the run-up to this farcical bullshit, the terms that North Korea was supposed to agree to in this joint communique or this ridiculous-ass agreement that these two assholes signed, nothing was there. The terms that North Korea was supposed to agree to were nowhere. They're not in the agreement. Nothing's there. But Trump wants us all to believe that through his genius and his ability to make deals like the world has never seen, he is so much better than all these other fucked up presidents of the United States who actually got deals signed, tough deals. Now, which is not to say that Kim is going to honor a goddamn thing. He and Trump are exactly alike. They're liars. They cheat. They do not keep promises of any sort. So we're supposed to celebrate this? We're supposed to believe that MSNBC made a brilliant broadcast decision by sending half their crew, or it seemed like half their crew, to Singapore, and the other half to sit in the MSNBC studios in New York and pontificate about horse shit? Oh, my God. I've said for years that one of the biggest enablers of rotten government in this country, of criminal government, and now of traitorous government, one of the biggest enablers has been television. So-called television news. Television punditry. It's crazy. It's just crazy. Now, I will stipulate that given the kind of rhetoric that was passing back and forth between these two fucking monsters prior to this meeting, the fact that they didn't immediately draw their knives and try to kill each other and blow up the world with it is probably a real mark of progress. But Jesus bleeding Christ, I mean, the buildup to nothing. Oh, everything's supposed to be signed? Where the agreement? Where's any kind of substantive agreement? Anything? All right, I'm going to read to you. It's not that long. It's 250 words. The full text of this pissy document signed by Trump and Kim. But first, I want to thank Sanjay Llewellyn, who's our sponsor tonight. Thank you, Sanjay. Sanjay has a message. Every Halloween, I now face the same dilemma. Do I throw on a sheet and trick or treat as a ghost? Or do I add a pillowcase and go as a Trump supporter? Well, you have about 6 months to figure it out, Sanjay. Thanks, Sanjay. It is a difficult choice, I know. I think this year there are going to be an awful lot of Klansmen out there running through the neighborhood saying, trick or treat or we'll fucking kill you. Oh, my God. All right. Here's the historic agreement. And they keep referring to this as an historic agreement. All right, you listen to the terms and you tell me. Joint statement of President Donald J. Trump of the United States of America and Chairman Kim Jong-un of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea at the Singapore summit. Harumph. President Donald J. Trump of the United States of America and Chairman Kim Jong-un of the State Affairs Commission of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the DPRK, held a first historic summit in Singapore on June 12, 2018. President Trump and Chairman Kim Jong-un conducted a comprehensive, in-depth, and sincere exchange of opinions on the issues related to the establishment of new U.S.-DPRK relations and the building of a lasting and robust peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. President Trump committed to provide security guarantees to the DPRK, and Chairman Kim Jong-un reaffirmed his firm and unwavering commitment to complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Convinced that the establishment of new U.S.-DPRK relations will contribute to the peace and prosperity of the Korean Peninsula and of the world, and recognizing that mutual confidence building can promote the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, President Trump and Chairman Kim Jong-un state the following. Now, here come the terms. Are you ready? There's only four of them. One, the United States and the DPRK commit to establish new U.S.-DPRK relations in accordance with the desire of the peoples of the two countries for peace and prosperity. Woo! Number two, the United States and the DPRK will join their efforts to build a lasting and stable peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. Woo! Number three, reaffirming the April 27, 2018 Panmunjom Declaration, the DPRK commits to work toward complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Woo! And number four, the United States and the DPRK commit to recovering POW MIA remains, including the immediate repatriation of those already identified. Okay, so what do we have? The only substantive element is the turning over of boxes of bones, teeth, eyeballs, rotted flesh that the North Koreans have sifted out of the dirt, I guess, and put in cigar boxes. We're going to get that back. Hip fucking hip hip hooray. Okay. We also get a commitment from the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, a commitment that they will work toward denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Any time frame there, boys? Well, at least by the 27th century. And what does this mean? The second one, United States DPRK will join their efforts to build a lasting and stable peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. What does this shit mean? I'll tell you what it means. Nothing. Now, there's more. Those are the four specifics. Aren't they specific? The statement continues. Having acknowledged that the U.S. DPRK summit the first in history, was an epochal event. Is that how you say that? Of great significance in overcoming decades of tensions and hostilities between the two countries and for the opening up of a new future. President Trump and Chairman Kim Jong-un commit to implement the stipulations in this joint statement fully and expeditiously. Well, I'll be goddamn. Well, there you go. Huh? Decades of tensions and hostilities. I don't think they were ever more tense or more hostile than they were 5, 6, 7 months ago when these two fuckwads were threatening the entire globe with nuclear annihilation so they could prove which one of them had the swinginest dick. My God. The United States and the DPRK commit to hold follow-on negotiations led by the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and a relevant high-level DPRK official at the earliest possible date to implement the outcomes of the U.S. DPRK summit. Well, okay. A relevant high-level DPRK official. Finally, President Donald J. Trump of the United States, in case we've forgotten, and Chairman Kim Jong-un of the State Affairs Commission of Democratic People's Republic of Korea, in case we've forgotten, have committed to cooperate for the development of new U.S.-DPRK relations and for the promotion of peace, prosperity, and security of the Korean Peninsula and of the world. Holy shit. This little murderous fuck from North Korea is making a commitment to guarantee the peace of the world along with this orange asshole who's a failed real estate developer. Where the fuck do we live? Whose acid dream are we all wandering around in? O-M-F-G squared. What an agreement. Now, I wonder if the fascist sewer outlets on the internet and in the evangelical Christian churches and on Fox are touting this as an historic agreement. Look what our great and glorious God-chosen leader has done for us. What has he done? Well, he's got a commitment. To do what? Why do you liberals always want specifics? It's a commitment. To do what? You know, in my lifetime, I have seen a number, because I've been curious, and you probably have too, a number of joint communiques issued after an historic meeting. Usually, if it's a joint communique that is indicative of a change in policy of the signatories, it will run hundreds of pages. Because there are so many details to work out. The United States and North Korea and their partners have been at war, in a state of war, since 1953. We've been operating under an armistice, which is a ceasefire. Wouldn't you think? Because it sure as hell crossed my mind that the first thing in this bullshit toy summit meeting, the first thing, had it been real, to have been addressed would have been an end to the state of hostility that exists between the United States and North Korea. Wouldn't that be a starting point? So now Kim and Trump are going to work toward world peace, even though they're still in a state of war. That's how fucking bizarre this whole thing is. That's how insane it is. And let me add, that's how goddamn meaningless it is. Well, one of the things that human rights organizations were hoping, you know, organizations like Amnesty International, that's a good one. Human Rights Watch. I mean, there are a number of human rights organizations whose sole raison d'etre is to bring an end to the kinds of atrocities against fellow human beings that are committed in these dictatorial regimes, such as North Korea's. Kim runs that miserable fucking enslaved little piece of shit real estate with the kind of brutality that you might expect from Genghis Khan? Here's something that I didn't know. Maybe you knew it. In North Korea, the widespread crimes that are committed by the regime against its own people. These crimes include extermination, murder, enslavement, torture, imprisonment, rape, forced abortions and other sexual violence, persecution on political, religious, racial, and gender grounds, forcible transfer of populations, the enforced disappearance of persons, and the inhumane act of knowingly causing prolonged starvation. End quote. All of which was concluded in a UN report that examined North Korea 4 years ago. This is the regime that Donald Trump has now declared is headed by someone with whom Trump has an excellent relationship. But Canada, fucking Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, why, he deserves a special place in hell. Dear God. Let me share with you a little bit from New York Times. North Koreans live in fear. That's by design. Just like Trump is, Trump built his whole platform, his whole campaign on fear. Fear, fucking horrible fear. Here they come, murders, rapists, gangs. North Koreans live in fear, which is by design and is reinforced by that country's ruthless police state. People accused of political crimes are arrested and sentenced to prison camps without trials, while their families are often told nothing as to what happened to their loved ones. Up to 120,000 inmates were in the country's four major political prisons in 2014, And in there, they were subjected to gruesome conditions, according to the UN report. Prisoners are starved, forced to work, tortured, raped. Reproductive rights are denied through forced abortions and infanticide. Infanticide. Trump's new best friend orders the deaths of babies. Not fetuses, fucking babies! Real, live babies! Some of the people in these prisons are executed, sometimes in public. And the UN report found that over the past 50 years, hundreds of thousands of political prisoners have died in these camps during that time. In addition to the political camps, the North Koreans also operate prisons for those accused of ordinary crimes. Some of these prisoners face long-term torture, starvation, and other sorts of suffering uniquely developed by the North Korean authorities. Since Kim assumed power 7 years ago, taking over from his father, he's consolidated his power through executions, like family members. In the first 6 years as leader, Kim has ordered the executions of at least 340 people. Kim has ordered the executions of 340 of his fellow countrymen. That's according to the Institute for National Security Strategy, a think tank arm of the National Intelligence Service. In 2016, Kim Yong-jin, the deputy premier for education, was shot to death in front of a firing squad after showing, quote, disrespectful posture, end quote, in a meeting. And then my favorite, and yes, I'm being just sarcastic and ugly when I say it, Hyun Young-chol. That's a general over the armed forces. He fell asleep in a meeting where Kim was speaking. He was the one who was executed with an anti-aircraft gun. That video is available online if you want to see it. There is nothing left of this miserable fuck that wouldn't fit inside an envelope. Executed with an anti-aircraft gun. One of Kim's uncles, Jang Song-taek, was convicted of treason. He was then executed with anti-aircraft machine guns, and his body was incinerated with flamethrowers. This is Trump's new buddy. And Justin Trudeau deserves a special place in hell. Kim Jong-nam, the estranged brother of Kim, was killed last year in a very public way near a check-in counter at Kuala Lumpur International Airport in Malaysia. Two women were seen on security cameras walking up to him, rubbing a substance on his face, a chemical warfare agent known as VX. He was dead within minutes. The women were arrested, but the United States said evidence showed that North Korea was responsible for the attack. There's more. Kathy, you want to say something?
You know, I'm really glad you're doing this. I was watching Stephanie Ruhle on MSNBC earlier try to explain some of the human rights crisis in North Korea and the history of it. And, you know, I think of all the MSNBC pundits, and of which a lot of them do deserve the criticism you're heaping on. And I have guilty feelings about Morning Joe because I think they elevated Trump early on by having him on so many times, but that's water under the bridge now. But I think she's a little bit more pure than the others. I think she always does try to...
Stephanie Ruhle.
Yeah, Stephanie Ruhle.
I think
she does a good job in trying to put the perspective in place, and she really did a good job detailing a lot of the things you're talking about today without the flamethrowers, but dear God... But a lot about the case system and how difficult it is for the people of North Korea, unless you're in Kim Jong-un's extreme inner circle and top tier of loyalists, then you're kind of screwed big time, and you risk death pretty much at every street corner. But one thing, just in the correlation between Trump and Un, is that look at what he's doing.
Trump and who?
Kim Jong-un. Un.
You said
Mr. Un.
Kim.
Mr. Kim, but, you know, Jong-un, right? And then his sister is Juno-woo or something. I don't understand the semantics. Semitic languages make me twitchy. But look at what Trump is doing with ICE agents and how he's rounding up children and incarcerating them. And putting them in detention centers.
Yeah, I've been talking about that.
Oh, of course you have. But, I mean, if that's not the first step toward dictatorship, then I don't know what is.
Well, we're past the first step. The first step was getting Americans used to the idea that there is a subcategory of people on this planet who deserve to die.
Right.
Muslims.
And blacks.
No, Muslims.
Okay.
That was the first international step, just like Hitler and the Jews.
Well, I guess you're reaching back farther than I am. I'm going to Trump's specific agenda, and as long as this monster's in the White House, he's also declared war on African Americans. He's allowed the police, he's given open season, don't be so careful with the heads, go ahead and beat the shit out of them, put them in jail, we don't care. They're black people, what do they matter? And we're saying this, they're Mexicans, they're rapists, they're criminals, they're killers, they're all gang members, they're all... MS-23 members. I mean, that's just ridiculous. So we have to steal their children and lock their children in internment camps. I mean, this is where we are as America. And then when Justin Trudeau says, excuse me, you guys don't look the same anymore, he's the enemy. That, I mean, if no one else is paying attention, you know, this is exactly what, go back and read It Can't Happen Here. I mean, this is exactly what happened, and the good Germans said, what? What are you talking about? No. And it's happening. We're locking up Mexican children. You try to find a Mexican on the street in Atlanta.
Not just Mexican children.
Well, no, of course. But, I mean, you and I have talked about it. You know, I don't see Mexicans in Atlanta anymore. They are gone. And, I mean, I don't mean to be any kind of, you know, like superior person. But all the people who you used to see working on houses, mowing lawns, doing landscaping work, working in your house, working outside, they are gone. The only people I see outside anymore who might be Mexican are wearing balaclavas up to their eyeglasses and they're covered, you know, head coverings. And they're like in hiding as they're on their riding mowers. I mean, this is terrifying to me.
All right,
and
now keep in mind that it's not just Mexicans.
Well, no, I know. I'm using my example.
It's Latinos.
Okay. You're right. I'm being politically short-sighted. All Latinos that we would see in Metro Atlanta, a large city with a large Latino population, seem to have disappeared from the streets. I mean, that's just in my personal observation, and
we talk about it
among our friends. Like, where'd they go?
Right.
We know where they go. They went in hiding. Our next door neighbor, who has is a contractor, and he employs a lot of Latino workers. He called me the other day, and he asked us if Venicio could hide in our backyard because. His alarm was accidentally tripped.
Tell the folks who Venicio is.
Yeah, Venicio is an electrician Vinicio is a licensed electrician who fled Central America, and he, as a licensed electrician, high in his field in Central America, but he fled to America, and he works for our next door neighbor, who's a general contractor, and he was over there when our neighbor was out of town working on his house, and he accidentally tripped the house alarm. And he had to, this man, who was a master electrician, had to come hide in our basement because he was afraid the police were going to arrest him. I mean, this is terrifying. This is where we are. I mean, this is like hiding Jews. The next step is hiding Jews in your attic. We're hiding an electrician in our garage.
If I might interrupt, you might want to be careful what you say because we'll get a visit now from ICE.
Yeah, right. Yeah, of course. You know, now they know our garage is probably, the next stop on the Underground Railroad for Latino electricians. But this is where we live now. I never thought I'd see the day when I'd have anybody call me up and say, can somebody hide in your basement? Right. Well, because the police are coming.
Well, the day is here.
Yeah.
The day is here. Let me mention one more time our sponsor tonight, Sanchez Llewellyn. Thank you, Sanchez. Sanchez's message. Every Halloween, I now face the same dilemma. Do I throw on a sheet and trick-or-treat as a ghost? Or do I add a pillowcase and go as a Trump supporter? Good question. One of the first human rights violations that human rights observers ascribe to North Korea, aside from preventing North Koreans from leaving their country, it's a fucking prison. You're not going anyplace. You're not getting out of here. But aside from that, the length of time it takes to indoctrinate the people of North Korea. And again, quoting from the New York Times, according to the UN report, which was prepared by the UN Commission of Inquiry, and it's more than 300 pages long, that report, North Korea, quote, operates an all-encompassing indoctrination machine that takes root from childhood to propagate an official personality cult and to manufacture absolute obedience to Mr. Kim, end quote. That report goes on to say that independent thought is bred out of these children, and propaganda glorifying Kim and the state is injected. And the propaganda is carefully designed and structured to, quote, incite nationalistic hatred toward official enemies, end quote. That sounds precisely like what Trump is doing. Oh, by the way, the hatred toward official enemies in North Korea, and, you know, it's justifiable, this official hatred. But the two countries that receive this are Japan and the United States. Japan, who, when they were in control of North Korea or Korea, took the Korean women to be used as so-called comfort women, which means the Japanese soldiers could fuck them at random until they were used up and then they were beheaded. So, yeah, I can understand North, South, East, West Koreans saying, fuck you, Japan. And as far as United States, the best estimate, it's not an estimate where it concerns U.S. war dead, where it concerned North Korea, the Korean conflict, about under 40,000, which is not to minimize it. 40,000 is a fucking atrocity when you consider why we sent troops there. Just like the 58,000 whose names are on the wall in D.C. that we sent to Vietnam. But yeah, we lost under 40,000 American soldiers. The Koreans lost 5 million people. So I find it perfectly understandable. I don't support it. I don't think it's a good idea, but it is perfectly logical, isn't it? That the North Korean government would instill, inculcate, plant, whatever you want to say, into every North Korean citizen from the time the citizen is old enough to walk, this vicious hatred toward Japan and the United States. But moving right along to more of the atrocities committed by this regime against its own people, North Korea considers the spread of most religions dangerous, just like the Chinese. But the, quote, particularly serious threat, because it provides a platform for social and political organization and interaction outside the realm of the state, end quote, according to the UN, is Christianity. Now, I happen to see Christianity in the United States as a, quote, particularly serious threat. So I guess on that level, Kim Jong-un and I are in agreement. We could issue a joint statement. Christians in that hermit kingdom are barred from practicing their religion. And those who are caught practicing Christianity are, quote, subject to severe punishments, end quote. North Korea's leaders also conflate Christians with those detained in prison camps, those who tried to flee, and Koreans considered to introduce subversive influence into that state. That's according to the UN report. In interviews with the New York Times in 2012, four North Koreans said that they had been warned that the gulag awaited those who spoke to journalists on Christian or Christian missionaries. One woman said, quote, if the government finds out I am reading the Bible, I'm dead, end quote. And in its 2018, that's now, the 2018 World Watch List, the Christian group Open Doors ranked North Korea the worst nation in the world for Christians. And in a statement last week, the group called on Christians to take part in 24 hours of prayer and fasting yesterday ahead of the meeting between Trump and Kim. 24 hours of prayer and fasting. Oh, that'll work. Yeah. Now, in the 1990s, this is an estimate, as many as 3 to 4 million people were believed to have been starved to death during an extended famine in North Korea in the 1990s. And then towards the end of that decade, North Korea began to recover, whatever that means. At the time, North Korea was using food as a tool to enforce political loyalty. And they prioritized the distribution of food that was donated by countries around the planet because, you know, the idea of allowing a population to starve to death is just something that most countries on Earth are not willing to do. Although we have Christian preachers in this country, like Reverend Hagee, who says, let them starve! But Hagee is a fucking demon. But the North Koreans used food donated by other countries as a way of enforcing dedication to the dear leader. And more recently, in those North Korean prison camps, the political prison camps, the inmate population in those camps has been culled through, quote, deliberate starvation, end quote. And suspects who are picked up for anything are also starved, quote, to increase the pressure on them to confess and to incriminate other persons, end quote. This is Trump's good friend. This is the man who Trump put his arm around, who shook his hand, who smiled and talked and had fucking breakfast with him. Or was it lunch? Jesus Christ. But now Trump, being the sick, narcissistic asshole that he is, will spend what? The rest of his presidency reminding the world about what a glorious and wonderful thing that he and his new best friend, Kim Jong-un, did in Singapore. Why they brought peace in our time. Wait, somebody else used that, didn't they? The guy with the umbrella? The Brit? Now, the consensus is put together pretty neatly by Nick Kristof. Let me just quote it directly. This is what he published today. It sure looks as if President Trump was hoodwinked in Singapore. Trump made a huge concession, the suspension of military exercises in South Korea. That's on top of the broader concession of the summit meeting itself, security guarantees he gave North Korea, and the legitimacy that the summit provides his counterpart, Kim Jong-un. Within North Korea, the very special bond that Trump claimed to have formed with Kim will be portrayed this way. Kim forced the American president through his nuclear and missile tests to accept North Korea as a nuclear equal, to provide security guarantees to North Korea, and to cancel war games with South Korea that the North Koreans have protested for decades. That's how to be presented to the captives who make up the population of North Korea. Back to Kristof. In exchange for these concessions, Trump seems to have won astonishingly little. In a joint statement, Kim merely reaffirmed the same commitment to denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula that North Korea has repeatedly made since 1992. It's been going on for 27 years. But I guess Trump doesn't know that. Trump crowed at his news conference after his meeting with Kim, quote, they were willing to denuke. Trump seemed to believe that he had achieved some remarkable agreement, but the concessions were all his. He's such a great negotiator, isn't he? A deal maker, right? Kristof goes on, the most remarkable aspect of the joint statement was what it didn't contain. There was nothing about North Korea freezing plutonium and uranium programs, nothing about destroying intercontinental ballistic missiles, nothing about allowing inspectors to return to nuclear sites, nothing about North Korea making a full declaration of its nuclear program, nothing about a timetable, nothing about verification, and not even any clear pledge to permanently halt testing of nuclear weapons or long-range missiles. Kim seems to have completely out-negotiated Trump. And it's scary that Trump doesn't seem to realize this. For now, Trump has much less to show than past negotiators who hammered out deals with North Korea, like the 1994 agreed framework, which completely froze the country's plutonium program with a rigorous monitoring system, which then fell apart. Trump made a big deal in his news conference about recovering the remains of American soldiers from the Korean War, but this is nothing new. Back in 1989, 40 years ago, or 30 years ago, on my first trip to North Korea, Nick writes, Officials there made similar pledges about returning remains, and indeed, North Korea has returned some remains over the years. It's not clear how many more remain. Trump claimed, quote, an excellent relationship, end quote, with Kim. And it's certainly better for the two leaders to be exchanging compliments rather than missiles. In a sense, Trump has eased the tensions that he himself created when he threatened last fall to, quote, totally destroy North Korea. I'm just not sure a leader should get credit for defusing a crisis that he created. There's still plenty we don't know and lots of uncertainty about the future, but for now, the bottom line is that there's no indication that North Korea is prepared to give up its nuclear weapons, and Trump didn't achieve anything remotely as good as the Iran nuclear deal, which led Iran to eliminate 98% of its enriched uranium. Now, Christoph doesn't say this, so I'll say it. The reason the Iran deal fell apart was because this fucking Israeli fascist, Benjamin Netanyahu, got inside Trump's head and convinced Trump to act all leaderly like Netanyahu does with the Palestinians and tell the Iranians to fuck off, which Trump dutifully did. Christoph adds there was also something frankly weird about an American president savaging Canada's prime minister one day and then embracing the leader of the most totalitarian country in the world the next. Trump said of Kim, quote, he's a very talented man. I also learned that he loves this country very much. What the fuck? In an interview with Voice of America, Trump said, I like him. He's smart, loves his people, loves his country. Trump praised Kim in the news conference and astonishingly even adopted North Korean positions as his own, saying that the United States military exercises in the region are provocative. That's a standard North Korean propaganda line. Likewise, Trump acknowledged that human rights in North Korea constituted a, quote, rough situation. But he quickly added that, quote, it's rough in a lot of places, by the way. In 2014, the UN report stated that North Korea human rights violations, quote, do not have any parallel in the contemporary world, end quote. Incredibly, Trump told Voice of America that he had this message for the North Korean people, quote, I think you have somebody that has a great feeling for them. He wants to do right by them, and we got along fairly well, really well, end quote. It is breathtaking to see a president of the United States emerge as a spokesman for the dictator of North Korea or the dictator of Russia or the dictator of China or the dictator of Turkey or the dictator of the Philippines. I added all that. Back to Christoph. One can argue that my perspective is too narrow. That's what counts is a broader sense. In a broader sense, is that the risk of war is much less today than it was a year ago, and North Korea has at least stopped its nuclear tests and missile tests. Fundamentally, Trump has abandoned bellicose rhetoric and instead embraced the longstanding democratic position, capital D, that we should engage North Korea, even if the result isn't immediate disarmament. Of all the things that could have been gone badly wrong in a Trump administration, a so-called bloody nose strike on North Korea leading to a nuclear war was perhaps the most terrifying. For now, at least, Trump seems to have been snookered into the same kind of deeply frustrating diplomatic process with North Korea that he has complained about, but that is far better than war. Oh, dear God. There's more. You can read Christoph's column, if not at the New York Times. Hard copy, go online. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be back for hour two momentarily. Stay with me. was I? Oh, yeah. Let me mention again, our sponsor tonight is Sanjay Llewellyn. Thank you, Sanjay. Sanjay's message. Every Halloween, I now face the same dilemma. Do I throw on a sheet and trick-or-treat as a ghost? Or do I add a pillowcase and go as a Trump supporter? Good question, Sanjay. You know, I've talked over and over and over again, or at least asked the question, about, or the question that pretty direct is, why do the Republicans in the House and the Senate allow Trump to continue when he's obviously not qualified? He's already committed maybe 7 impeachable offenses, serious ones. He is violating the oath that he took when he was sworn in to protect and defend the United States. He's opened the United States up to all sorts of retaliatory moves by countries that Trump has literally, well, not literally, but figuratively pissed on. The latest, of course, being what happened in Canada last weekend, where Trump broke all rules of protocol. And forget rules of protocol. He just was a shitty human being, which is what Trump is. He has absolutely no thoughts about somebody else's feelings unless those feelings are his. Everything relates to him, as we know. But the insulting remarks that he made to Justin Trudeau and the other members of the G7 that were there will take a long time to be forgotten, if they ever are. Trump is isolating us and isolating us and isolating us. While at the same time, he makes nice with some of the worst leaders on the planet, among whom now is Donald Trump. But Paul Krugman has a column, A Quisling and His Enablers. What's a Quisling? Anybody know? I should see a show of hands. That term was used quite a bit during World War II, especially in Europe. Especially in France. A Quisling is a politician who serves the interests of foreign masters at his own country's expense. Now, Trump is very close to being just that. When you stop and think how in the past few days Trump has defended Russia while at the same time attacking our closest allies, what the hell does that tell you? Now, I know there are some people on the left still who want to make nice with some of these dictators. And frankly, I don't know what screws have come loose in some of these folks on the left. I'm still on the left. I'm so far left, I'm off the chart. But some of the liberals and leftists who've always maintained that, well, you know, we should treat the Russians nice. We should treat the Chinese nice. We should treat the dictators nice, which is horseshit. I mean, it has never worked in the past. It's not working now, and it's never going to work in the future. I don't know who it is that thinks that by making nice with someone who murders his own people, including members of his family with fucking anti-aircraft guns, for God's sake, someone who maintains a gulag, someone who tortures people, how do you make nice with a leader like that? A lot of people were asking that question of the United States during Bush's reign. How do you make nice with a government that purports to be a democratic republic of, by, and for the people, but at the same time, it will gather up people randomly in Afghanistan or wherever they can get their hands on them and torture the shit out of them? I mean, how do you identify that country? Well, here's a quick label: the United States. I've mentioned over and over and over again, if there is justice in this universe, which I do not believe there is, I really don't. I believe there are laws of physics. You could say that Newton's, what is it, first or second law of, what do you call it? Newton's law of?
Motion.
Is it motion?
Physics, motion, energy.
Energy conservation.
Conservation of energy.
Conservation of energy. And for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, which would be motion. If
you want
me to say this,
if
we believe that, and there's no reason not to, because it's in
Mike,
it's in the realm of math.
Yeah, the laws of conservation of energy says that energy or matter can't be created or destroyed, only transformed from one form to another, usually with a loss of heat.
Just okay, thank
to
you.
To be clear, what you're quoting are Newton's laws of motion.
Okay, thank you.
Equal and opposite reaction.
Okay, thank you very much.
Until met
well,
with
if,
it. Do you want
that
me to,
law
no,
is immutable, and apparently it is, I guess that would stand as the physical definition of justice, action-reaction. And in a manner of speaking to me, that means no escape. You can't do something without expecting the something that you've done to not generate some sort of reaction along the lines of the thing that you did. I guess it's kind of out there in the ozone, but that's, I guess, how I see things starting to or used to or may or whatever. But if that's the case, what the United States has done to so many countries will eventually produce a day of reckoning, if it hasn't already. But a quisling is where I started. Politician who serves the interests of foreign masters at his own country's expense. And of course, Trump has displayed himself as the perfect quisling in the past few days. You ever notice there are two names that Trump never, ever, ever, ever brings up to denigrate? Two. Putin and Avenatti, the attorney representing Stormy Weather. Michael Avenatti and Vladimir Putin. Ever wonder why? So do I. Anyway, Krugman, Paul Krugman, in his column, asked if we ever wondered why Trump defends Russia while he attacks our allies. I mean, that seems like something out of Joe McCarthy, out of the senator from Wisconsin when he accused the U.S. government of being chock-a-block with commies back in the day when commies were our deepest, dearest enemy, right? Nobody knows what Trump's motivation is, as Krugman points out, in always defending Russia, never coming out and naming Putin as the son of a bitch that he is. Blackmail? Bribery? Or, in Trump's case, it could be a generalized sympathy for autocrats, dictators and the like, and Trump's hatred for democracy. Trump doesn't like democracy. There are very few, if any, capitalists who do. It's much easier to do business with a dictatorship once you have made sure that the dictator understands that if he does do business with you, you're going to make his life extremely easy. Doing business with democracies is difficult, if not sometimes not impossible, which is one of the reasons, of course, the United States supported dictatorship after military dictatorship at the expense of hundreds of thousands of lives in Central America. The American capitalists just wanted to do business there. I mean, my goodness, you have a problem with that? And of course, it's not just been in Central America. It's been all over the goddamn world. But that's us, right? That's us. So about the only way we have of finding out what Trump's motivation is in this fucking scam that he's been running as so-called president of the United States, the only way we're going to find out is if it comes through the Mueller investigation. Now, if Trump shuts down the Mueller investigation, or if Republicans retain control of Congress, what Trump is doing may never be made public. Anyway, as Krugman points out, and I fully agree, the people who are enabling Trump's betrayal of America, that's the inner circle of officials and family members and media personalities who are willing to back up no matter what he says or does, or find an excuse for it, or immediately point out the speck in the beholder's eye who is accusing Trump. In other words, the entire Republican delegation in Congress, those sons of bitches couldn't care less, which is astonishing to me. They have the power, the Republicans in Congress, House and Senate, and they have the more importantly, they have the constitutional obligation to stop what he's doing. But the Republicans won't lift a finger to defend the country. I mean, that's where we are. We have an attack on this country that is ever widening, ever spreading, and it's an internal attack. It's not coming from the motivation, the directive is coming from outside the country, but the damage is being done inside the country by Trump and this group of treasonous sons of bitches who surround him, including his fucked up family. Who are nothing but a bunch of high-end grifters, every single one of them. What was this I heard today? Ivanka, since her filthy old man has been president, Ivanka has made $80 million? Jesus fucking Christ, what is that about? Well, what it's about is the scam that Trump and his thieving, lying family are running against this country. But the Congress won't do a goddamn thing to stop any of it. Nothing. Krugman writes this: it's important to understand that the fight Trump is picking with our allies isn't about any real conflict of interest. Because our allies are not, in fact, doing the things that Trump accuses them of doing. Canada and Europe are not imposing massive tariffs on U.S. goods. That's a fucking lie. A vast majority of U.S. exports enter Canada tariff-free, and the average European tariff is 3%. Those are not disputable issues. I don't give a shit what the sewer dwellers on Fox say. Those are simple facts. So, Trump then is justifying his attempt to destroy every single Western alliance that is still functioning by accusing our allies of shit that exists only in Trump's fevered brain. Krugman writes, the same thing may be said about his claim that Canada's Justin Trudeau somehow betrayed Trump, and undermined the Group 7 summit meeting. In reality, Trudeau's remark at the end of the conference was restrained and conventional, simply asserting, as any normal leader would, that he would defend his nation's interests. And then the Trump rage tweet that followed was responding to an insult that, like those massive tariffs, only exist in this odd fucker's imagination. But that's Trump. By the way, this is a jerk-off whose presidency has generated about 7 lies per day while he's been in office. 7 lies per day. And it would be greater than that, except Trump doesn't – I mean, he has executive time when he's watching television or eating his cheeseburgers. Otherwise, the lies would be greater in number. So Krugman says, okay, what about his officials in his government? Well, they've been acting like the courtiers in the old story about the emperor's new clothes. If the boss says something whose falsity is obvious to anyone with eyes to see, they'll claim to believe what he just said. This is no different, my gentle listeners, than what happens in North Korea with Kim. If Kim says the sun has turned blue, and he says it before a massive audience of North Koreans, they will all turn towards the sun and shriek the word blue in North Korean. Because to do otherwise might mean they'll be executed with a fucking anti-aircraft cannon. That's what Trump wants. Larry Kudlow. Is he still alive, Kathy?
I'm not sure.
The guy that had the heart attack, his Trump's so-called chief economist. And you ought to put economist in quotes. Larry Kudlow is an asshole that was on CNBC. He was a business shouter, a screamer, and the economist. Jesus Christ. The reason he's working for Trump is because he gives Trump virtual blowjobs anytime Trump wants one. I said virtual. Anyway, Kudlow, right before he had his heart attack, went on television to screech that Justin Trudeau, quote, stabbed us in the back. And then Peter Navarro, who's supposed to be Trump's trade expert, put the word expert in quotes too, he went even further. He repeated Kudlow's stab in the back line. And then he's the one that declared Trudeau faces, quote, a special place in hell. Well, hey, Navarro, pay attention, you asshole. Look what happened. Action, reaction. Look what happened with Larry Kudlow. For his smart remarks, he winds up with a fucking heart attack. What are you going to wind up with, Peter? Something. Something evil is slouching your way, my half-witted pundit. And Krugman also reminds us there was the rumor or the story or the hope or the suggestion that once he won the electoral vote and it became clear that this miserable fucker was going to be the next president of the United States, that what would check him, what would keep him in at least partially on a narrow path as being president of the United States would be the wise people who would surround him, because after all, if you're an economist or real one, or if you're a foreign affairs expert or whatever your field of expertise is, and you're dedicated to your profession, not coloring it Democratic or Republican, but you're dedicated to the profession, well, there are lots of people out there who Trump could have hired. Who did he hire? Who did he hire? We may have started out with a couple of hires that had the potential, the possibility of restraining this fucking moron. But how long did they last? Eh? Plus, they were a good percentage of them were criminals in their own right. I mean, look at Larry Flynn, look at Manafort, look at Papadopoulos, all these people, and God knows how many more are going to float to the top of the jar of toilet water when Mueller releases his report. But those people now have been replaced to the point where Trump is surrounded by these sycophants who will tell him whatever he wants to hear, while at the same time patting his ass, stroking his beautiful hair, and telling him that he's such a wondrous leader. As a matter of fact, he was chosen by God. By God. What the fuck is that? What is that? So not only is Trump psychotic, he's a carrier of psychosis. Every fucking person around him has come to the point where they have no problem substituting Trumpian bullshit for what little shreds of reality left that they can still identify. So at the point where Trump can talk about, you know, his bromance now. Now he's got another dictator that he can play grab the penis with. He's got Kim Jong-un now. Oh, that'll make him happy. Oh, shit. These dictators, is it not clear, are role models for Trump. They're who he wants to be. But anyway, blah, 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 blah. As Krugman points out, America is not, not yet anyway, a monarchy. Congress has the power to check a president who seems to be betraying his oath of office. But I'll tell you, if anyone has betrayed his oath of office, and I'm sure there have been a few, Trump leads that fucking parade by a mile. He's way out in front of all the other assholes who've wound up in the presidency. Anyway, the Congress can remove him. But if they don't have the courage or the stomach, or they're worried about being reelected, if they don't have the ability to impeach him, there are other ways that members of Congress could constrain Trump and limit the damage he's doing. One of the quickest ways would be to stop confirming these fucking gangsters that he keeps appointing to positions of unbelievable power in this country. Think Scott Pruitt. Think Betsy DeVos. Think Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. Jesus fucking Christ. But, whoa, hold up, stop, wait a minute. Congress is controlled by Republicans. And as Krugman points out, their response to a president whose actions are manifestly not just un-American, but anti-American. That's what Trump is doing. But the response to Congress has been, oh, a little sad tweet here and there, and a handful of senators who are unhappy about our glorious leader, but they're sure as fuck not going to do anything about it. And most Republicans haven't even gone that far. They're just silent, except the ones who are leaving office.
Yeah, I wanted to jump in again because there's a disturbing trend that I'm noticing that is following this inaction of Congress, and it's emboldened the racists in society to just go wreak havoc on innocent people. I mean, on normal folk. I keep reading story after story, and these are not just Instagram or Facebook memes or some crap or urban legends. This is an increasing level of just flat out racism and violence and hatred and bigotry on display in America because, you know, they get the message. They're not stupid. It's okay to look at some little Asian kids and at 5-year-old children in a restaurant and tell them to go back to the hell where they came from. They don't belong in this country. That's acceptable. You know, and whereas normally under other circumstances in different administrations, people would be aghast and horrified. Now it's barely newsworthy that this is happening every day. And it's because these people see it. They see that nothing's happening, that this racist, misogynist asshole, oh, they're all outraged over Roseanne Barr getting fired. You know, that was ridiculous. You know, but she's the only person so far in 2 years that's met any consequence for racist behavior. It's just been given free rein. And of course, if members of Congress are going to tolerate it, then why isn't that a green light for every Archie Bunker in America to just run wild? You know? And they are.
Right. That's very true. So, the question I've had, and I'm sure you've had it, why are these Republican politicians unwilling to take on the responsibilities that the Constitution of the United States hands them. Why not? You've got to believe, because I damn sure believe it, and I'm not the only one, for Christ's sake, but you've got to believe, based on the evidence that is in front of us every single day, not because I believe it, but because of the evidence that's in front of us every single day, that a de facto foreign agent sits in the Oval Office. Trump. But the members of Congress, these Republican politicians who have the power to stop this shit anytime they want to, as Trump points out, they are immobilized by a combination of their own venality and cowardice. That's exactly the truth. Venality and cowardice. So any Republican politician, the way it stands now, who tries to represent what the Constitution mandates these politicians to represent, all of a sudden becomes terrified that he or she is going to be challenged in a primary by somebody from the Nazi right who is promoted by Trump to get rid of members of his own party who are suggesting a little bit of restraint. Just a little bit of restraint. Fuck you. So they get primaried. And as far as I've seen, there's not a single, not one, not a single elected Republican who's willing to take that risk. And it doesn't make any difference what Trump does. Listen to the last two sentences that Krugman wrote for today's publication. Quote, what all this tells us is that the problem facing America runs much deeper than Trump's personal awfulness. One of our two major parties appears to be hopelessly, irredeemably corrupt. And unless that party not only loses this year's election, but begins losing on a regular basis, America as we know it is finished. Yeah. And right about here is where I cynically inject, God damn, aren't we glad we don't have Hillary Clinton as president? You know, no telling what was on her email server. Jesus bleeding Christ. You know, I've wanted to do this for quite some time. I'm going to do it now. What the hell? I don't know if you've read the book, They Thought They Were Free, The Germans, 1933 to 1945. It was written by one Milton Mayer, published by University of Chicago Press, and it was reissued in paperback in 1981. Let me quote a little bit. This is Uncle Mike's Story Corner, and I don't want to play the Mr. Roberts music because it would be too freaky. What no one seemed to notice, said a colleague of mine, a philologist, was the ever-widening gap after 1933 between the government and the people. Just think how very wide this gap was to begin with here in Germany. And it became always wider. You know, it doesn't make people close to their government to be told that this is a people's government, a true democracy, or to be enrolled in civilian defense or even to vote. All this has little, really nothing, to do with knowing one is governing. What happened here was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret. to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand, or so dangerous that even if the people could understand it, it would not be released because of national security. And their sense of identification with Hitler, their trust in him, made it easier to widen this gap and reassure those who would otherwise have worried about it. This separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised as a temporary emergency measure or associated with true patriotic allegiance or with real social purposes. And all the crises and reforms so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter. You will understand me when I say that my middle high German was my life. It was all I cared about. I was a scholar, a specialist. And then suddenly I was plunged into all the new activity as the universe was drawn into the new situation, meetings and conferences, interviews, ceremonies, and above all, papers to be filled out, reports, bibliographies, lists, questionnaires. And on top of that were the demands in the community, the things in which one had to, was expected to, participate in that had not been there or had not been important before. It was all rigmarole, of course, but it consumed all one's energies coming on top of the work one really wanted to do. You can see how easy it was then not to think about fundamental things. One had no time. Those, I said, are the words of my friend the baker. One had no time to think. There was so much going on. Your friend the baker was right, said my colleague. The dictatorship and the whole process of its coming into being was above all diverting. It provided an excuse not to think for people who did not want to think anyway. I do not speak of your little men, your baker, and so on. I speak of my colleagues and myself, learned men, mind you. Most of us did not want to think about fundamental things and never had. There was no need to. Nazism gave us some dreadful fundamental things to think about. We were decent people, and kept us so busy with continuous changes and crises and so fascinated, yes, fascinated by the machinations of the national enemies within and without that we had no time to think about those dreadful things that were growing little by little all around us. Unconsciously, I suppose, we were grateful. Who wants to think? To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me. Unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness, acuity, than most of us ever had occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained, or on occasion regretted, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood that the whole thing was in principle what all these little measures that no patriotic German could resent must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. One day, it's over his head. How's this to be avoided among ordinary men, even highly educated ordinary men? Frankly, I do not know. I do not see, even now. Many, many times since it all happened, I have pondered that pair of great maxims, Principius Obsta and Finem Respis. The first one, resist the beginnings, and the second, consider the end. But one must foresee the end in order to resist or even see the beginnings. One must foresee the end clearly and certainly. And how is this to be done? By ordinary men or even by extraordinary men? Things might have changed here before they went as far as they did. They didn't, but they might have. And everyone counts on that might have. Your little men, your Nazi friends, were not against National Socialism in principle. Men like me who are, or were, the greater offenders, not because we knew better, that would be too much to say, but because we sensed better. Pastor Niemöller spoke for the thousands and thousands of men like me when he spoke, too modestly of himself, and said that when the Nazis attacked the communists, he was a little uneasy, but after all, he was not a communist, and so he didn't nothing. And when they attacked the socialists, and he was a little uneasier, but still he was not a socialist, and he did nothing. And then the schools, the press, the Jews, and so on. And he was always uneasier, but still he did nothing. And then they attacked the church, and he was a churchman, and he did nothing. By then it was too late. You see, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for the one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join with you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even to talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble. Why not? Well, you're not in the habit of doing it. And it's not just fear of standing alone that restrains you. It's also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor, and instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside, in the streets, in the general community, everyone is happy. One hears no protest and certainly sees none. You know, in France or Italy, there will be slogans against the government painted on walls and fences. In Germany, outside the great cities, perhaps, there's not even this. In the university community, in your own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom certainly feel as you do. But what do they say? They say, "It's not so bad," or, "You're seeing things," or, "You're just an alarmist." And you are an alarmist. You are saying that this must lead to this, and you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end, and how do you know or even surmise the end? On the one hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party, intimidate you. On the other, your colleagues poo-poo you as pessimistic or even neurotic. You're left with your close friends, who are naturally people who have always thought as you have. But your friends are fewer now. Some have drifted off somewhere or submerged themselves in their work. You no longer see as many as you did at meetings or gatherings. Informal groups become smaller, attendance drops off in little organizations, and the organizations themselves wither. Now, in small gatherings of your oldest friends, you feel that you are talking to yourselves, that you're isolated from the reality of things. This weakens your confidence still further and serves as a further deterrent. To do what? It is clear all the time that if you are going to do anything, you must make an occasion to do it. And then you are obviously a troublemaker. So you wait. And you wait. But the one great shocking occasion when tens of or hundreds or thousands will join you never comes. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and the smallest, thousands, millions would have been sufficiently shocked by it. Let's say the gassing of the Jews in 1943. If it had come immediately after the German firm stickers on the windows of non-Jewish shops in 1933. But of course, this isn't the way it happened. In between came all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. Step C is not so much worse than step B. And if you did not make a stand against step B, why should you at step C? And so on to step D. And one day, too late, your principles, if you ever were sensible to them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy. And some minor incident, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, "Jew swine," collapsed it collapses it all at once, and you see that everything has changed and changed completely under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concert, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, the spirit is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear, and the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Now you live in a system which rules without responsibility even to God. The system itself could not have intended this in the beginning, but in order to sustain itself, it was compelled to go all the way. You've gone all the way almost yourself. Life is a continuing process, a flow, not a succession of acts and events at all. It has flowed to a new level, carrying you with it, without any effort on your part. On this new level, you live. You've been living more comfortably every day with new morals, new principles. You have accepted things you would not have accepted 5 years ago, a year ago, things that your father, even in Germany, could not have imagined. Suddenly, it all comes down, all at once. You see what you are, what you have done, or more accurately, what you haven't done. You remember those early meetings of your department in the university when, if one had stood, others would have stood, perhaps, but no one stood. A small matter, a matter of hiring this man or that, and you hired this one rather than that. You remember everything now, and your heart breaks. Too late. You are compromised beyond repair. What then? You must then shoot yourself. A few did. Or adjust your principles. Many tried, and some, I suppose, succeeded. Not I, however. Or learn to live the rest of your life with your shame. This last is the nearest there is under the circumstances to heroism. Shame. Many Germans became this poor kind of hero, many more, I think, than the world knows or cares to know. I can tell you of a man in Leipzig, a judge. He was not a Nazi, except nominally, and he certainly wasn't an anti-Nazi. He was just a judge. In 42 or 43, early 43, I think it was, a Jew was tried before him in a case involving, not only incidentally, relations with an Aryan woman. This was race injury, something the Nazi Party was especially anxious to punish. In the case a bar, however, the judge had the power to convict the man of a non-racial offense and send him to an ordinary prison for a very long time, thus saving him from Nazi Party processing, which would have meant concentration camp, or more probably deportation and death. But the man was innocent of the non-racial charge, in the judge's opinion, and so, as an honorable judge, he acquitted him. Of course, the party seized the Jew as soon as he left the courtroom. And the judge? Yes, the judge. He could not get the case off his conscience, a case, mind you, in which he had acquitted an innocent man. He thought that he should have convicted him and saved him from the party. But how could he have convicted an innocent man? The thing preyed on him more and more, and he had to talk about it, first to his family, then to his friends, and then to acquaintances. And after the putsch in 1944, they arrested him. After that, I don't know. And once the war began, resistance, protest, criticism, complaint, all carried with them a multiplied likelihood of the greatest punishment. Mere lack of enthusiasm or failure to show it in public was labeled defeatism. You assumed that there were lists of those who would be dealt with later after the victory. Goebbels was very close, very clever here, too. He continually promised a victory orgy to take care of those who thought that their treasonable attitude had escaped notice. And he meant it. That was not just propaganda. And that was enough to put an end to all uncertainty. Once the war began, the government could do anything necessary to win it. So it was with the final solution of the Jewish problem, which the Nazis always talked about but never dared undertake, not even the Nazis, until war and its necessities gave them the knowledge that they could get away with it. The people abroad who thought that war against Hitler would help the Jews were wrong. And the people in Germany, who, once the war had begun, still thought of complaining, protesting, resisting, were betting on Germany's losing the war. It was a long bet. Not many made it. An excerpt from They Thought They Were Free, written by Milton Mayer. You know, there have been – I haven't read that – I don't think I've ever read the entire book. I've read a series of essays taken from it, like the one I just shared with you. It's been a while since I have read any of it. When this popped up on my computer screen the other day, I thought, oh, Jesus, really? So now it's time to get the book. They Thought They Were Free. And I swear that you know, the insidious little comparisons to Nazism, I know they're tiresome. They're tiresome to me. And the comparisons would be better identified if they were labeled comparisons to fascism. And so I try to do that. I try to mention fascism. I'm trying to eliminate the word Nazism out of my vocabulary for a number of reasons, not the least of which it is tiresome. And it's a word that puts people off, even people who realize what's going on in this country under Trump. So I've chosen to go with the word fascism. But it's happening. It is happening. It is happening. It's happening here. It's happening now. We have display after display, day after day, week after week, of the insidiousness of this fascist disease. And my biggest concern right now, maybe it's a fear, but it feels right now like a concern. My biggest concern are the midterm elections coming up in November. An awful lot of people are putting an awful lot of hope into these elections. The hope is that the Democrats will assume control of the House. The hope is that they will increase the number, their number in the Senate. Their hope is that this will result in restraining the country's headlong rush into fascism with this fucking moron taking us there. But I'm really concerned about that. And every day, every week that goes by, I get even more concerned. Because in a way, and I think in a very fundamental way, we're not paying attention to what is happening. And we've got historical reference after historical reference to use as a guidebook. If A happens, and it's not really noticed that much, and then opens the door to B, and then B is a little bit worse, but not that much, and opens the door to C, and C is a little bit worse, but not that much, and opens the way to D, just like Milton Mayer said. I hate to find myself fixated on anything. I really do. I just hate it. I have found over the course of my life that when I fixate on something, it's going to devour me until I can extract myself from it. But I am fixated right now on what is happening politically in this country, what is happening with Trump being the leader. I'm fixated on it. I'm concerned about it. I'm worried about it. And I feel, as I've mentioned several times in these podcasts, I feel totally impotent, totally unable to do a goddamn thing. I can sit here 2 hours a night and blah, blah, blah. Doesn't mean shit. Doesn't mean a thing. So what to do? Do we do like Milton Mayer's friend said in that little excerpt? Do we just busy ourselves with all the little details of our everyday lives and forget about what is moving underneath us inexorably towards a conclusion that none of us is going to like? What to do? What to do? Well, I'll give it some thought tonight and maybe I'll have a solution in tomorrow's podcast, which is bullshit. I mean, no way. But I'll see you then. In the meantime, take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.